You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
Welcome to Intergenerational Politics with Jill Winebanks and Victor Shi, where we host weekly political discussions that are engaging and relevant to all generations. As always, we want to thank you for listening to Intergenerational Politics. If you haven't done so already, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts to support future episodes. And we also have a website, intergenerationalpolitics.com. This is Victor Shi. I'll be an incoming freshman next year at UCLA, was elected as the youngest Joe Biden delegate in Illinois, and also co-hosts this podcast with Jill.
And I'm Jill Winebanks, delighted to be Victor's co-host. I'm the author of The Watergate Girl, based on my experience as the only woman on the trial team. And of course, I had to show my book because we're talking to a famous author today, and we're going to be talking about her book. I'm also an MSNBC legal analyst and former general counsel of the U.S. Army and a bunch of other things. But we're very happy today to be with our special guest.
Yes. So we are joined today by Mary Trump, who is the perfect guest to help us understand or try to make sense of President Trump's past actions and policies and to evaluate his underlying psychology and potential for future harm in the next month and in the next 4 years. Mary Trump is the niece of Donald Trump, a psychologist, and the author of Too Much and Never Enough, How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man, and soon to be author of a second book called The Reckoning. And we will be talking to her about all of this.
Thank you so much for being here, Mary. We're delighted.
Oh, gosh, Jill, I'm thrilled. I'm really excited to be here with you. And I just want to show my book, too, so people
please
see how...
Oh,
here's the cover.
Wait, we have a copy with the picture. Hold it up, Victor.
Right here.
So, for all I just can't have that laying around my house.
Oh.
Okay, I get that. I really do. But in fact, let's start talking about that book, because as a fellow author, that's always the first thing I want to talk about. And you have a very unique perspective on Donald Trump because you are a psychologist, but you're also his niece and you basically have known him your whole life. So that made me wonder whether this dual viewpoint as both a professional and as a relative made it easier or harder to write your book.
Oh, that's a great question. In some ways, it was both. You know, I think as a family member, it made it harder because not the stuff about Donald so much, but the stuff about my dad and my grandfather, you know, that was really difficult in ways I could not have anticipated because I was revisiting things I had very deliberately chosen not to think about for many, many years, you know, like decades. So dredging all of that up was definitely a challenge, especially as some of that was happening during COVID, which made everything harder.
Right.
But in terms of my training, it actually made it easier because, you know, I had to take a step back a little bit and try to be objective as far as I was possible under the circumstances. And I was able to understand things in a way that I never did before, because it's not like I was ever before this book interested in analyzing my family from a clinical perspective. So it ended up being although difficult, a really fascinating journey. And I learned a lot.
That does sound fascinating. And it makes me think you are good at compartmentalizing and suppressing your own personal feelings to make this more professional evaluation. Do you think that's true?
Yeah. When I started this book, I had three rules. One was no anger, no bitterness. Two was don't engage in any ad hominem attacks, which I don't do anyway, but you know, I wanted to, that needed to be a rule as well. And the third one was don't be demeaning of anybody, including myself. So those really helped me. I mean, the hardest one was anger, for sure. But it wouldn't have worked if I had come at this from a place of having been wronged and with those feelings. And again, in terms of my dad, that was really difficult.
Yeah, that's, you know, I had a similar problem because I was sharing in my book, not just Watergate history, but my own personal traumas during that time, which included a bad marriage, which I wanted to be honest about, but to be protective of my ex-husband in a way.
Yeah. I mean, I just want to say something really quickly because your book is phenomenal. And the part about it that I found most moving was the personal stuff because not because it, to me, it was so connected with the professional stuff, or at least it gave a perspective on the professional stuff that we wouldn't have had otherwise. And it was also incredibly brave. So I really appreciated that. Wow. So thank you.
Thank you. So one of the questions I'm frequently asked in book tours is, what was the moment you thought to yourself, I simply must write this book and I must do it now? Mm-hmm. What was that moment for you?
It was actually after I had been working with the New York Times team who wrote that astonishingly brilliant investigative piece on my family's finances.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I use the phrase working with very loosely. They did all the work. I just handed over a bunch of documents. But, you know, it wasn't just that. I had lots of conversations with them, giving them background. And when I decided to take the leap to help them by giving them the documents, I realized for the first time that I actually had proof of something. Yeah. And, you know, the question I get is, well, why didn't you do this 4 years ago when it could have helped? Well, it wouldn't have helped because I didn't have anything. It literally would have been my word against his. He was getting away with everything, including insulting people like John McCain and disabled reporters and you know, admitting to sexual assault of women on tape. So what could I possibly have said? But with this article, it essentially distilled all of the information that existed in those 40,000 pages of documents, which belonged to me. So I finally had something concrete to point to and say, look, it's not just my opinion anymore. And also in the course of all of those incredible conversations I had with Sue Craig and Russ Buettner, I realized that this is a really incredible story. And I knew Donald was gonna be a total disaster, and not being able to do anything was driving me crazy, just sitting on the sidelines when he enacted the Muslim ban, when he started kidnapping and incarcerating children and things were getting worse and worse every day. I was like, you know what? I have something that I can hold in my hand now, this article, and I have a story, and it's time because people need to know exactly who this person is.
It probably did make a difference. People said, well, you should have done it 4 years ago, but it may have helped in the election outcome in 2020. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, you know, that was my hope. Obviously it's impossible to gauge. And it's also, it's impossible to gauge what kind of influence it may or may not have from the privacy of your own living room. You know, it's like, we're not out in the world. So, you know, I'm getting a very narrow slice of people who have read it or maybe been affected by it. But, you know, I've heard from people on Twitter saying that their Republican brother-in-law read the book and voted for Biden. So that's incredibly gratifying. It doesn't change the fact, however, and I don't mean to be negative, but because I am, if that's the case, it's something I would be very proud of. But 74 million people, you know, still voted for the guy, which is just extraordinary.
So did you think, or just broadly speaking, while he was on the campaign trail and now 4 years as president, did anything surprise you, or was all of this predictable based on the man you knew in a family setting?
Absolutely nothing he did surprised me. The only thing that surprised me from the beginning was the extent to which the entirety of elected Republicans was willing to sell its soul for this incompetent, unworthy, cruel, despicable, inexperienced man who knows nothing. You know, that continues to surprise me, actually. I don't know why. It shouldn't anymore, but it does.
It surprises me too. Yeah. And I wonder if in your training, there's anything that you could say about what it is that Donald Trump has that makes the Republican Party and his voters so loyal and so ignore facts and policies that hurt them.
Yeah, you know, I think it's much more complicated when we're talking about his voters. But if we're just focusing on Republicans in Congress or in the cabinet, I think there are three general categories. There are the true believers, who, in my view, are incredibly weak, and also admire what they perceive to be Donald's strength, which, by the way, doesn't exist. He's an incredibly weak person as well. However, he has what they think is the he's rich, and he is unfortunately legitimately powerful right now. So they admire those things and they aspire to them in some ways, I suppose. And they like being around it. And as you've probably noticed, if you're sycophantic enough, Donald will have you on over to the White House, no matter who you are. So there's those people, which I don't think there's much we can do about them. There are people in the middle who are just afraid. They're afraid of a mean tweet. They want to cling to their power, so they don't want to disrupt anything. These are the people who in private talk about how horrible he is, and then publicly either say nothing or just go along with it. And then there are the people like Mitch McConnell and Bill Barr. And one of the fascinating things about Donald is, yes, he appeals to weak people whom he can use, but he also is somebody who, because of his character, so to speak, is eminently useful to smarter, more powerful people. So people like Bill Barr and Mitch McConnell have no use for Donald as a human being, but they know how to get whatever they want to get out of him. They're the most dangerous, in my view.
Oh my God. Well, I'm getting I'm getting a lot of Steve Schmidt, Rick Wilson vibes from that. But I want to move on to the opening of your book. And if you don't mind, I want you to read something on page 26. And it's basically in the opening of your book, you talk about how Trump's character and behavior was influenced by his father, Fred. I think it might be fun for you to read that and nice for our audience to hear that from you.
Got it. From the beginning, Fred's self-interest skewed his priorities. His care of his children, such as it was, reflected his own needs, not theirs. Love meant nothing to him, and he could not empathize with their plight, one of the defining characteristics of a sociopath. He expected obedience, that was all. Children don't make such distinctions, and his kids believed that their father loved them, or that they could somehow earn his love. But they also knew, if only on an unconscious level, that their father's love, as they experienced it, was entirely conditional.
So that is, you know, a tough assessment. And I assume that attitude did have a dramatic impact on who Donald is now, right? Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. His intense maneuverings to change the narrative when he has been humiliated by something. And we also see it in the way he so gleefully humiliates other people.
Mm-hmm. I think one through line, especially with your book, is just how much you mention how environments from a young age shape children. And I guess, you know, that to me, that to a lot of people, it seems like basic psychology, but can you kind of speak more to how much kind of environments do shape children at such a young age, and why, you know, if you're raised to kind of have, you know, if you're raised to despise humiliation or weakness, how that affects the person once they grow older?
Yeah, I mean, if we look at it in terms of Donald, for example, you know, when he was 2.5, his mother became very ill, and not her fault. She was absent from his life for a significant period of time, almost a year. 2.5 is an extraordinarily important developmental period in a child's life. So like, that's when children most need to be seen, you know, while as they're developing their individuality, that's when they most need to be soothed. And that's most when they need to have their needs attended to, right? Mm-hmm. So with her absence, he essentially lost his primary connection to human love, right? He had older siblings who were, you know, had their own needs. And the only person who really could have stepped in was my grandfather, the sociopath, who even then was only interested in his oldest son and namesake, my dad, who was 7.5 years older than Donald. Mm-hmm. So you have a child in this terrifying situation in which, you know, he never knows when his needs are going to be met. He never knows if he's going to be left alone or for how long he's going to be left alone. There was nobody there to explain these things to him. So in order to survive that psychologically and emotionally, he had to develop these very intense defense mechanisms, mm-hmm. Which over time kind of hardened into personality traits like, you know, pretending that he couldn't make any mistakes, pretending that he didn't really care about other people, being a bully, that kind of thing. The tragedy of that, there are two tragedies. One is when my grandmother recovered to the extent that she did, she didn't really do anything to heal the wounds that had been created by her absence in the first place. Mm-hmm. And then, which maybe was even worse, or maybe was made possible by the fact that my grandmother didn't really intervene, the defense mechanisms that Donald developed and the character traits that they resulted in appealed to my grandfather, because he wanted his successor to be a killer, to be a tough guy, to be somebody who would win at all costs. And that's who Donald became, one, to stave off the terror and the isolation, but two, to make sure that he didn't suffer the same fate as his older brother.
That is for sure. And then you also mentioned that Fred hated weakness. You write that Donald's older brother, Freddie, who is your father, did not become Fred's successor as intended because Fred found him too weak, and that was basically a deal breaker for your grandfather, Fred. And so as a result of your father's failure to please your grandfather, you write that your father became addicted to alcohol and then unfortunately then died. So that information plus the information that we've already discussed about Fred and Donald makes this seem to be like a really toxic family in a sense. You know, did Fred's behavior also affect the president's mother and the sister? Kind of how did the family dynamic kind of play out?
Yeah, it was an incredibly toxic family. And again, when I started thinking about the book, one thing that struck me was that my grandparents had 5 children, and every single one of them is in one way or another a deeply damaged, if not destroyed, human being. Hmm. That's quite a record. you know, that speaks to a horrific household and horrific parenting. I think that clearly my grandfather was the driving force, and he was a sociopath. There's no two ways about that. Mm-hmm. But my grandmother played her own part. You know, she was not either able or willing to protect the kids from their father, and she was, you know, she was really self-involved in a way that made it difficult, if not impossible, for her to give her children the kind of comfort they needed over time. And I think it was her relationship with Donald, or I guess I should say her treatment of Donald, that probably had more of an impact than with any of our other children.
It is totally fascinating.
For sure, yeah. Yeah. You mentioned the successor and how Father Freddie was supposed to be the original successor, but then it was because of Freddie's weakness that I guess Fred then turned his attention to Donald. So I guess what in particular made Donald so special for Fred, or was it that, you know, he was just the only other son, so he became one, you know, by default, or was it, you know, any chance that his sister Mary Ann could have also become one, or was it also maybe because of gender in that scenario?
Well, first of all, my grandfather was a world-class misogynist, so there's more of a misogynist than Donald, honestly. Oh, wow. Just saying something. So there's no way my Aunt Mary Ann, who was the oldest child and very bright, and capable, but there was no way he would ever in a billion years turn to her. And as for my dad, this is the problem. It's not that he was weak. It's that according to my grandfather's worldview, right, he was weak. So Freddie was kind. He was generous. He was really funny. And he was incredibly accomplished, but in ways that my grandfather found trivial. Mm-hmm. You know, he was a consummate boatsman. He was a great fisherman, and as it turned out, he was a brilliant pilot. But none of those things was necessary in running a real estate empire, so they were dismissed out of hand. So it's not that he turned away from Freddie because he was, you know, a bad person or a weak, you know, weak in the way we would consider it weak. You know, he wasn't lazy or anything like that. It's just that he didn't appeal to my grandfather's sense of, you know, what was necessary. And also, as many sociopaths do, my grandfather used other people as extensions of himself. And as soon as he realized that Freddie wasn't going to be a person he could use to his own ends, he turned his focus to Donald, who, having witnessed all of this, mm-hmm. from the advantage of being 7.5 years younger, was absolutely determined to play the role required of him. Otherwise, he would have ended up just as dismantled and destroyed as his older brother, who, by the way, was just, you know, objectively speaking on paper, a much better person and a much more accomplished person than Donald ever could be. So that was also very confusing. But when you live in a family in which everything is a zero-sum game and there can only be one winner, and you've seen what can happen if you don't do what's necessary in order to win, you become Donald, basically.
Yeah, I mean, well, so we talked about Donald when he was a child. I just want to move on a little bit to when he was an adolescent and Trump's misbehavior. So you write a lot in the book how that consisted of fighting, bullying, arguing, you know, that I guess that shouldn't surprise us, but it reached to a point where Fred sent Donald to New York Military Academy. So I guess first, like, why was that? And then also, did sending Trump to military school help at all? Or do you think that might have made things a little bit worse?
Oh, well, first of all, my grandfather sent him because it was easier. You know, Donald was a pain in the ass. He was getting in trouble at school. And it was a school in which my grandfather was on the board of directors. So, you know, it was annoying and he didn't want to deal with it. I don't think he particularly cared one way or the other. He was still focused on Freddie. And, you know, he wasn't home. He worked all the time. So if the school hadn't complained about it, I don't think he would have bothered. But my grandmother was also at her wit's end because Donald treated her so poorly. But that, by the way, was also, I think that was the final break with between her and Donald, because not only did she not lift a finger to protest against his being sent away in eighth grade, she really wanted him gone. So I think that for Donald was the final betrayal. As for his experience at the military academy, I actually think it made things worse, because it was another environment in which he learned that what matters is having the power, not deserving it. Because it was a very, back then, top-down environment in which if you were the superior officer, so to speak, you could do whatever you wanted. You could beat up underclassmen if they looked at you funny, you know? So he learned that, okay, it doesn't matter if I'm good or if I'm skilled. It only matters if I have more power. So that's not a lesson he needed and reinforced, but it was.
Well, consistent with that, you write a lot about the strong man desire of your uncle. And of course, the American people have seen that for ourselves in terms of how he portrays himself and also how he affiliates himself with authoritarian dictatorial leaders who would be the strong men that he aspires to be. But what we're seeing now is, in addition to that, he won't accept losing. So what, in your professional opinion, explains these two character traits? You know, both the strong man desire and the refusal to, I would say, see facts and reality, not accept losing. And what are the consequences now with Trump refusing to acknowledge Biden's victory and telling his voters, I really won. I got more votes in Georgia. And despite three recounts that have all said, he lost.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, those are great questions, because we are going to be dealing with them for a while, unfortunately. As for the strongman stuff, you know, as I mentioned earlier, my grandfather, for reasons which continue to escape me, because we're talking about real estate in Queens and Brooklyn in the 50s, but my grandfather wanted a killer. Like, it wasn't that dangerous to collect rent, but whatever. So, you know, Donald could never acknowledge weakness of any kind and, you know, was clearly the most important person in my family, even eventually more important than my grandfather, who, as he got older, became kind of sycophantic towards his middle son, which was very weird. But the problem is, Donald is a very weak person, and he really doesn't have any internal strengths. He's not good at anything. He's just been really lucky. So to me, the tell here isn't his power grabs, because that's what quote unquote strongmen do, right? They try to overturn elections. They try to delegitimize their opponents. It's the way he behaves with legitimate strongmen, like Putin and Erdogan and Un. You know, he behaves towards them like his followers behave towards him. You know, in those relationships, he's the sycophant. So it's really fascinating. But I think, you know, it just shows that when he's confronted with real strength, and don't get me wrong, I mean, they're despicable people, and the world would be better off if none of those people was in power, but they are not through, well, in some cases through chance and luck and, you know, just having been born to the right person, but, you know, they've been trained in a way that makes them not just powerful, but capable of wielding the power, which is something Donald never will be. So I think we see two things happening, generally speaking, with this, his reaction to this decisive loss to President Biden. Mm. First of all, we see the desperation of a man who has aspired to something who believes that he deserves to be in the position he's in, despite having done nothing to earn it. And I believe that, you know, he didn't legitimately win in 2016 either. But that also plagues him because he knows that in some ways he's never been legitimate. You know, he wasn't even the legitimate successor to my grandfather, but that's a different issue. So we're seeing that desperation. He kind of doesn't understand. He so deserves to be an autocrat forever. He doesn't understand how that's not happening, especially given the fact that, you know, he basically did everything in his power to cheat, lie, and steal his way into another 4 years in the Oval Office. The other more, in some ways, more troubling part for us is the fact that he's in a situation he's never been in his life before, which is that he's lost. Again, he's never won anything legitimately, but in my family, it's not the process of winning, it's the fact of winning. So even if you won by cheating, lying, and stealing, all that matters is that you won. And he's always been able to brazen his way through a quote unquote loss and turn it somehow into a win, whether it's declaring bankruptcies, but then getting hundreds of million dollars more from banks, you know, whether it's building a development with which he had nothing to do, but he gets to take credit for it. Whatever the case may be. Now, we've seen he's tried everything in his power to steal this one so he can get the win, and he can't do it. And that's making him insane. And that's very, 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 very dangerous because one, it's something he's emotionally and psychologically incapable of processing and dealing with. And two, he knows that if he can't overturn the results of this election, he no longer has the power of the Oval Office protecting him as of January 20th, 12:01 p.m. And he is looking down the barrel of lawsuits, of serious financial difficulties, because why would the banks not call in their debt at this point? And three, very serious state-level criminal charges from which he cannot pardon himself. So he's a very cornered man.
It's definitely he is facing all of that. And one sort of additional question here is, do you think he's delusional or does he actually somehow believe? I guess it's the same thing. Do you think he's delusional in believing, for example, his own claims that he won the 2020 election? Or does he just not care about fact and he's just blatantly lying?
Yeah, well, yeah, this is one of the things about Donald that's kind of fascinating. It only happens when there's a lot at stake. I think initially he knows the truth and that saying he won is a lie, but the urgency of making the lie true is so great. And the urgency of getting other people to believe the lie is so great that he kind of gaslights himself into believing it, which is why we see over time his claims kind of become more grandiose and ridiculous, but at the same time more compelling to people who are willing to listen, because there is this weird sense of authenticity about them. Like, who would go on and on about this if there weren't some grain of truth, right? According to people who were primed to listen to and believe him. So I think that's much more dangerous because, it's dangerous anyway, but when there's this air of authenticity behind these completely ridiculous and erroneous claims, that changes the fact that puts us in a situation where he's convincing people that they've had something taken from them, which makes them angry. And again, is going to make it so much harder for the incoming Biden-Harris administration.
So maybe the most important question then is there any way for people who care about facts to get those facts into the minds of the people who are believing your uncle? He uses what I would consider to be traditional propaganda tools. Mm-hmm. Say it loud and say it often.
Yep.
And as you said, be authentic about it. But how can that be overcome? What message can get through to people so that they understand that there was nothing fraudulent about the election, that he lost it fair and square? Is there any hope for that?
I don't think there is. And that's entirely down to our elected Republicans. What they have done here is it's beyond disgraceful. It's anti-democratic. It's anti-American. And they should all suffer serious consequence for it, which I'm afraid they won't. But every single one of those 126 Republican representatives who signed on to that frivolous, fraudulent lawsuit brought by the Texas AG should not be seated in the next Congress. They should not be. You should not be rewarded in this country for sedition. So I think we missed the opportunity, because every day that went by with Republican leadership saying absolutely nothing, refusing to acknowledge President Biden, is a day in which more and more people started to doubt the legitimacy of the election. And it's a tragedy, but it's also criminal.
It's playing a role right now in the Georgia election. Loeffler is still refusing to admit that he lost the election, and it's really seriously frightening. You've made some very good points there, so thank you on that.
And I think that raises a point that you write about in your book, and this is a quote that I found striking, I think kind of encapsulates everything about Donald, is that this is far beyond garden variety narcissism. Donald is not simply weak. His ego is a fragile thing that must be bolstered every moment, because he knows deep down that he is nothing of what he claims to be. I guess, you know, one word that people at the Lincoln Project often throw around is, you know, it's become a cult of personality. Like, would you agree with that? Like, and I guess, like, first, like, define cult, and then, like, how does that apply to what Trump has made his supporters and Republicans in Congress into?
Yeah, this is a very difficult topic for me to grapple with, because I'm not objective, obviously. I tried as a thought experiment about a month ago. I said, okay, you need to put aside your own prejudices, find something good about Donald that kind of can give you some insight into why people admire him, which again, don't understand. I couldn't come up with anything. I could have probably 25 years ago, but I don't, and this is the problem. I look at him and I see an unworthy, incompetent, cruel, I can go on and on for hours with adjectives that describe what I think of him. So it makes it really difficult for me to see what is it that other people are attracted to here. He's so weak. He's so whiny. He's so pathetic. He's so unintelligent. And so what is it that's going on? And I think it's because, you know, the only way to understand it is to stop looking at it from the perspective of somebody who doesn't admire him at all. Okay, so what could be going on? Part of the thing is that there are people, a certain percentage of people in any society who have authoritarian personalities. They are attracted to the quote unquote strongman, even if the strongman is really a weak man. But you know, the weak idea, person's idea of a strongman. Also, because of his privilege and position, you know, as I said earlier, he does have power, to which people, and money, none of which really belongs to him, but you know, most people don't believe that, which people find attractive and they want to be around that. And more than anything else though, I think it's kind of simple. He hates the right people. You know, they like his racism and misogyny and cruelty, which is terrifying, but he's also elevated the politics of grievance to an art form. And he appeals to people who feel left behind, who feel that they have been underserved by their government. And, you know, this is something else we can thank Republicans for. This has been a 40 years long project to undermine people's faith in government and convince them that government is like a hostile foreign power, when the government is us. You know, it's ours. It's it doesn't just represent us, it is us. You know, it's like this thing with the, you know, federal money. That's our money. It's not like it belongs to the federal government, who, like, you know, has been having its own bake sales. It's our money. So, you know, you convince somebody over time to vote against their own self-interest and be suspicious of their own government. And like, that's why we see people saying, oh, Obamacare is the worst, but I love the ACA. Well, okay. Keep your government hands off my Medicaid. Well, guys, I got news for you. So it's just another stunt that's been pulled on these people, which is driven in part, and not just in part, I think largely, by the demographic changes that are going to put the Republicans in a minority for all time, which is why they're so desperate. Yeah. So they're going to do whatever they can to stoke up the rage and division on the right, no matter how unfounded the reasons for it might be.
One question I think a lot of people are wondering about is, do you think Trump will walk out of office? You know, now that he is projected to be, you know, he's the loser of the election, do you think he'll walk out of office and just, I guess, fade away? Or will he continue elevating himself and Trumpism? And like, will it get worse from here? Like, is this just the beginning for him?
Yeah. fading away is not something that he will do willingly. I was talking to Don Lemon last night, actually, and he said something really interesting, because, you know, I'm focused on Donald's desperation vis-a-vis criminal charges and potential bankruptcies and lawsuits and no longer having the power of the Oval Office to protect him. And Don was saying that he thinks that the thing that Donald's most terrified of is no longer being relevant. And I mean, I think that's part of it, but I think he's right. I think that is the worst thing that could happen to him, is being irrelevant. So we see he's fighting tooth and nail. Like, he's the reason he didn't concede initially was because he couldn't wrap his mind around the fact that after all of the cheating he had been doing, it didn't work. And he'd never lost before. So how can you, you know, take that in? But over time, it became more about staying relevant, because lame duck people kind of are beside the point, aren't they? And just wait until after inauguration. Historically, it's sort of like Barack who? I mean, obviously not to that extent, but you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, he's going to go off and do his own thing, and we're not going to pay that much attention to him. If that happened to Donald, I think he would cease to exist. So he's going to do whatever he can. But it shouldn't be up to him. It is incumbent upon the media to turn the page. And if they don't, they will once again be failing this country in a way so egregious that, you know, we may never get out of this.
That is a tragedy, I think, the way you're describing it. You've mentioned a number of times the money, the power. I want to focus on the money, his taxes, and how much he may owe. And thank you for your role in bringing to light some of the facts that underlay what he has done. Based on everything you know, do you think that the state investigations, Cy Vance, or Letitia James, who's the New York State Attorney General, do you think that there are crimes that he will be charged with, or that there will at least be taxes that he will owe?
Yeah, I don't have any special insight into that. I haven't been contacted. The documents that I had in my possession are very old, so they wouldn't be useful. But what I will say is that between the 2018 article that the Times wrote, mm-hmm. essentially rewriting the financial history of my family and showing that, you know, Donald was a millionaire from the time he was a toddler, and was not a self-made man, and they did engage in all sorts of tax fraud and money laundering. And the article they published recently about, more specifically about Donald's taxes, mm-hmm. And how little he made and how few taxes he paid, what we see is a pattern of behavior. There's literally no reason for me to believe that that pattern ever stopped. That those behaviors never stopped. So I think there's plenty there for Vance and James to go forward. Also, I'd say, even though these things don't necessarily have anything to do with each other, but I think that the way Donald has behaved since the election has been so abhorrent and dangerous that it increases the urgency of holding him accountable, even if it's only at the state level. So in other words, obviously there's nothing to charge him with, okay. But if there is, there's every reason to think that this time they will, unlike pass in the past when they either looked the other way or decided not to bother. That's not gonna happen this time, especially if the Biden administration, and personally, I think this would be a really big mistake, decides not to allow, well, I don't know, that's the right word, but decides to make the same mistake other administrations have made, including Obama's, and say, you know, the past is the past, we need to look forward. No, we don't need to look forward. We need to find out what happened and hold people accountable for the first time in our history. But, you know, if that doesn't happen, then I think there's gonna be even more pressure at the state level.
Well, you're talking to somebody who has believed since the time of Nixon that a sitting president can be indicted, yep. and should be indicted when the evidence supports it. Yep. And so you won't have any argument from me about holding someone accountable. Mm-hmm. I want to refer, before I turn this back to Victor, to an article that a neighbor sent me last night that arrived just sort of coincidentally before talking to you. And it's called What the Science of Addiction Tells Us About Trump. And it's written by James Kimmel Jr., a lecturer in psychiatry at the Yale University School of Medicine. And I know I didn't give you any advance warning or let you see this, but it so reflects some of the things you're saying and says that we need to be compassionate about Donald Trump because it's not necessarily a moral failure, that it is sort of much like drug addiction, that it is a physical mental disorder. And so does that, you know, make you have any compassion for the adult as opposed to, you know, you might be compassionate about the child who was treated badly and developed these defensive mechanisms, but it's sort of like blaming your parents when you're 40 years old. It's time to stop blaming them and take responsibility for developing better behaviors. I thought it was an interesting article, but it didn't make me feel compassionate about an adult not seeking help, because it does also say these traits require assistance. They require professional help. Can you comment on that at all? And I'll send you the article later.
Yeah, I would love to read it, actually. You know, I think there is a lot of explanatory power in viewing certain of Donald's behaviors as addictive. Mm-hmm. You know, addictions run through my family. My dad, obviously, was an alcoholic. I think my grandmother was an alcoholic. They were first cousins. My father's generation, there were first cousins who died from alcoholism. But, you know, Donald's addictions take all different forms, obviously. And I think Donald is addicted to attention. I think he's addicted to money. And, you know, maybe the power that comes with money, not sure. But, you know, you can't treat something that's not acknowledged, right? And as you said, it requires that. So you can't blame somebody for being addicted. You can't even blame them for not acknowledging it, because, you know, he's also a narcissist in some ways. So like, if a narcissist goes to therapy, it's not to, because they think there's something wrong with them. It's because they think there's something wrong with everybody else, right? So, and in my family, the things that are of interest to Donald, like attention and money, were normal things, at least for him, because of my grandfather, to want to have as much of as possible. That having been said, and yeah, again, if you want to have a compassion for it, you know, knock yourself out. But, you know, as I've said, I know plenty of people who had much worse childhoods who turn out to be kind, empathetic, and, you know, generous adults. So that's not an excuse. Have compassion for the child, sure. But as you said, we all need to grow up at some point and take responsibility. But okay, so what happens if you don't recognize what's wrong with you? Well, does an addiction to money or attention explain his cruelty? Mm-hmm. No. So people with addictions, people with mental illnesses are not necessarily bad people, but they can be, and they're just not related. You know,
they also have it in their power to get better by getting help. And certainly your uncle's problems have been pointed out by the media for quite a long while. So, and going back to this article by Kimmel, it does talk about addiction to revenge and the good feelings that come from achieving that. When you have the weaknesses that you've identified in your uncle. Let me move to one other question, which is about what do you think President Trump has on the Republican Party, on maybe his aides, maybe on his voters? Why is it that he has been able to continue his narrative despite the absence of facts to support it?
Yeah, it is extraordinary, because it's impossible to believe that all, 100% of elected Republicans are just totally okay with all of this. So there has to be some percentage of them who are being coerced in some way. That some of them certainly act like they are, for sure. I don't have any special information about this, but what we do know is that it wasn't just the DNC that was hacked, the RNC was hacked. Difference is, none of the RNC emails has been released to date, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. So I think Donald has whatever somebody like Putin has. I mean, look at what we just learned about this vast and terrifying cyber attack by Russia. I mean, they've infiltrated practically everything, it seems like. So do we really think that because Donald has done nothing, said nothing, made no moves, again, enabled by McConnell, who's also done nothing, even though he certainly had the power to, would we be surprised if there aren't files on every single Republican senator and congressman? I think that would be naive to suggest that that's not the case. What I find depressing, though, is that, like, how bad could it be? Like, I'm going to assume that some of it's really bad, but some of it's just kind of humiliating life stuff, right? Is it really worth destroying your country over? Like, anybody who came out and said, look, I'm being blackmailed for this reason, I'm humiliated, but my country matters, that person would be a hero for all time. But it's this weakness that I just find it's kind of mind-blowing, actually.
Actually, the cyber attack and President Trump's failure to do anything in response may actually be the most horrible crime he's committed so far. But I want to move to, I have one last question and Victor has one last question. Okay. you're in the process of writing your second book, The Reckoning. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us something about it and when it's going to be coming out?
Yeah, I'd love to. This is a book that I think is similar to the first book in that not in terms of its topic, but in terms of its mission, so to speak. Mm-hmm. We are looking down the barrel of the worst mental health crisis this country has ever encountered. And we are at the best of times not equipped to deal with it. So in this book, I kind of take a look back to see, you know, how did we get here? Because the crises we're currently facing were completely avoidable, which is why I personally think that, yes, I agree with you, the crime Donald's committing by doing nothing about Russia's continued cyber attacks, including the ones in 2016, are horrible crimes for which he really should be held accountable. But I think his essential murder of hundreds of thousands of Americans is up there too. But that's how I view it. Considering it was all avoidable. So I look back and as we were speaking earlier about the failure to hold people accountable. I mean, it started with Robert E. Lee. You know, there are universities named after a man who betrayed his country, also that he and his fellow criminals could have the privilege of continuing to torture and murder Black people. So it goes all the way through Andrew Johnson, Andrew Jackson, Woodrow Wilson, on and on and on to Donald. And, you know, we need to grapple with that and we need to be prepared. And, you know, because if we don't do that, you know, and if we don't reckon for the first time ever with the trauma in which this country was born, you know, genocide of two populations and the enslavement of a population, I mean, not only have we not atoned for that stuff, we've barely even acknowledged it. So if we don't start to do that, then things like this are going to continue to happen. So, and it's why we are so ill-equipped, why we got into this situation. So, okay, what are we going to do about it? And the what are we going to do about it part is probably the reason I think this book is urgent, because, you know, come summer when we're emerging finally from our COVID lockdown, we're going to be looking at increases in PTSD, depression, anxiety, domestic abuse, child abuse, substance abuse, the likes of which we've never seen before. We need to be prepared for it. And we need to start laying the groundwork for changing our system so that we can stop treating mental illness like it's some kind of, moral failing, and stop treating mental health like it's a luxury.
Wow, that is such an important book, especially for now. And Jill and I know we can't wait to read it, and we hope our audience will too. And we would love to have you back after you do write that book and it's published, because it would be such a timely book to talk about. One last question, you know, for me, so I took psychology in high school, and this was such a fascinating discussion, just like the class. And I've learned a lot, but is there anything you would like to tell our audience about Trump, your first book, or the one that you're writing now, and, you know, anything that we didn't ask that you would want our viewers and listeners to know?
I think honestly, the most important thing to keep in mind is that Donald will do anything to, you know, if he feels that he can't stay in power, which is should even be coming clear to him, he's going to take all of us down with him if he feels like he's going down. And I know that sounds melodramatic, but I think it's, we've seen it happening already. He's perfectly willing to destroy our democracy to protect himself. So that's not going to change, especially if the Republican Party, which by the way, is the only entity on the planet other perhaps than Vladimir Putin, who can rein him in or box him off or contain him somehow. So since that's the case, we need to keep putting pressure on the media to do its job. And in this case, its job would be to turn to what's really important, and that's the incoming Biden-Harris administration.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we thank you so much for helping us understand Trump a little bit better. But thank you so much for your time, Mary.
It was wonderful. We enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you both so much. This was a phenomenal conversation, and I enjoyed every second of it. So
likewise.
We
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Intergenerational Politics. Be sure to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts to support future episodes. Thanks so much. See you in our next episode.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.